though, from up in the mountains. The private gated community aspect doesn't mean jack now. Since the power is out, they have to leave the gates wired wide open. I'm trying to organize things to get that situation changed pronto. Ian nodded, and Alex went on. The house where I bunk is 3,800 square feet, and it had just a couple living in it. They have room for at least two more full-timers. And believe you me, I need the help. We gotta get continuous 24/7 shifts going right away. Alex pulled into the general aviation gate at Love Field. After the formalities of getting through the inner gate, he was able to drive right next to where the pair of Lerons were tied down. They all exchanged hugs and shared some tears about the death of Linda, but then they were all busy with their first concern, getting the planes unloaded. All of Ian and Blanca's gear fit with ease in the back of the excursion with its third-row seat folded down. Alex mentioned that he was impressed with how much Ian had been able to shoehorn into the planes. Ian explained almost apologetically, "I ran the weight and balance numbers, but they were marginal. Balance was decent, but gross weight was really pushing the envelope. Sometimes you just got to do what you got to do and pray for the best." As Alex shut the back doors on the Ford, he said, "Judging from the guns that you brought, they will not say no to hiring you." His prediction proved right. That evening, after some brief objections about extra mouths to feed, Ian and Blanca were hired by the four homeowners. Like Alex, Ian and Blanca would receive no pay, but would be provided meals and a comfortable bedroom. Their room was in the 2,750-square-foot home that sat behind the one Alex was in. It belonged to Dr. Robert Karvalich, a widower who was a retired pediatrician. Everyone called him Dr. K. Many years before, he had served a stint as a Navy medical officer, but only in an office setting, never at sea or in combat. He carried a World War II vintage Remington Rand Model 1911 in a full flap holster daily. The gun, he explained, had belonged to his father, who was also a Navy doctor during the Korean War. Unlike the other homeowners, who took several weeks to get accustomed to constantly carrying guns, Dr. K took to it immediately. The difference was that he had been robbed at gunpoint once before. As he told it, 6 years before the crunch, Dr. K answered his door to find a drug addict with a pistol in his hand. The man was after narcotics. Fearing for his life, Dr. K reluctantly complied, giving the robber his small supply of Tylenol with codeine, Vicodin, and an oral solution of morphine sulfate. The robber fled in a car with California license plates and was never caught by the local authorities. When Ian Doyle asked everyone in the compound to be armed at all times, Robert Karvalich was one of the first to do so. Transporting the planes to Dr. K's house the next day at first seemed like it would be difficult, requiring borrowed trucks, but then it proved easy. They just flew them there. The street in front of the four-house compound, as Alex called it, was curving and on a slight slope, but there was a long, wide street a quarter mile away that was straight and nearly level. This street was in the new Phase 2 portion of the Conley Ranch's development, where the streets had been paved, but only a few lots had been sold, and no houses had yet been built. In Phase 2, the streetlight poles had not yet been installed. The street made a very practical runway for the Lerons. They were able to land there and then just taxi the planes to the street where Alex lived. The sight of this made quite a stir in the community. Soon after they stopped the planes in the driveway, one of the neighbors from down the street came to threaten to file a complaint about the plane's landing as a safety nightmare and about the very presence of the planes. She shouted that the planes were flagrantly against the association rules. As she stood wagging her finger in Alex's face, Blanca and Ian were already at work disassembling them. Once the wings were removed and the planes disappeared into one of the bays in Dr. Kay's capacious four-car garage alongside his RV, the neighbor quieted down. Alex talked some sense into her by emphasizing that she'd be the indirect beneficiary of the additional armed security at no cost.
"Well, I suppose that's okay,"
she said quietly, and walked off. The Doyles, Ian, Blanca, and Alex, agreed to each stand a daily 8.5-hour guard watch, 13 days out of each 2 weeks. The intense guard duty schedule left them very little time for recreation, and hardly even enough time to hand-wash their laundry. But at least all of their meals were provided by the four families on a rotating schedule. Blanca began to carry one of the M-16s that Ian had taken in for safekeeping from Luke Air Force Base. Alex provided her some 5.56-millimeter ammo, both for target practice and to keep in loaded magazines. She disliked the M-16, mostly because of the odd twang sound that the buffer made in the buttstock when it was fired. She also considered the gun ugly, but would not elaborate beyond saying,
"I know a good-looking gun when I see one, and this one ain't it. I like a gun with at least some wood. This thing is like a plastic toy."
The Doyles wanted to construct a sandbagged fighting position inside each ground floor exterior window, but they ran into a problem, a shortage of sandbags. There were no nearby Army or Marine Corps installations, so the local surplus store had no sandbags available. And because Prescott was not in a flood-prone area, the county had just a small supply of sandbags for use if a water main broke. The local feed store had had its supply of empty feed sacks wiped out by just a couple of customers long before the Doyles inquired. It was Blanca who came up with the answer, sewing their own, using rolls of black polyester mesh road construction underlayment material. This material came in 10-foot-wide rolls. They were able to trade a local road contractor a box of 30-06 ammunition for two rolls of the material. Because the power was out, electric sewing machines were not available, but Dr. K put his late wife's Singer treadle sewing machine table back into operation. The table's sewing machine had been discarded years before, when the table became a decorator item. But Dr. K was able to install a much later model Singer machine into the treadle table. This one sewing machine eventually served the families in all four homes in the compound for everything from patching blue jeans to making ammunition bandoliers. It proved capable of sewing the sandbags as well. They cut the material to yield completed sandbags of the same 14-by-26-inch dimensions that had been standardized for U.S. military sandbags for nearly a century. Each sack weighed about 40 pounds when filled. Once filled and stacked, to the casual observer, the stacked black sacks looked like dark shadows inside the windows. The sandbag making and filling project went on for 3 weeks. Clean sand was available from a large pile at the development's uncompleted golf course. When asked permission to use some of the sand, Cliff Conley replied,
"You take what you need. I expect it'll be a long time before that golf course ever gets finished. Just don't ask me to help you fill 'em. I did my share of sandbag filling in Vietnam. I've now reached the supervisory stage of life."
By SOP, all wireless connections were turned off for fear that they might be detected by passing looters. Ian and Blanca settled into an upstairs bedroom that sat above the living room, which was heated by a wood stove. A floor vent gave their bedroom sufficient heat. More importantly, the bedroom had a sliding glass door to a story deck with a commanding view of much of the compound and the neighborhood. A hot tub sat on the corner of the deck, already drained for winter. It was soon lined with sandbags, turning it into a soft-top pillbox. The hot tub's plywood lid was covered with Nauga hide and had flaps that hung down 6 inches. Ian and Blanca constructed a C-shaped framework with 5 2-by-4 legs to support the lid. This positioned the lid 7 inches higher than normal, providing a 360-degree horizontal vision slit. To anyone walking by on the street below, the hot tub cum pillbox didn't look like anything out of the ordinary, just a covered hot tub. Ian also cut 5 blocks from a length of 4x4. These blocks allowed them to raise the lid an additional 3.5 inches to provide better vision and hearing at night. Because his master bedroom in the north wing of the house was too cold after the grid power went down, Dr. K moved a single bed to what had formerly been his den. The den was just off the living room, and thus it was well heated. He and the Doyles then closed off the hallways to nearly half of the house by nailing up blankets with batten boards to confine the heat to just the kitchen, living room, and den. The four families staged a coup at the Conley Ranch's Homeowners Association, HOA, meeting just a few days after Ian and Blanca arrived. By prearrangement with their sympathizers, they ousted 2 Pollyanna members of the HOA board. Both of them had wanted to maintain the status quo in the development because they were hoping for an economic recovery in the near future. They were replaced with down-to-earth pragmatists. In a series of voice votes that began almost immediately after the change in HOA leadership, all of the Conley Ranch's restrictions on landscaping, gardening, pets, livestock, fences, antennas, solar panels, fuel storage, and vehicles were eliminated. Once it became apparent that they were badly outnumbered and that they were getting no traction at the meeting, the 2 Pollyannas and their handful of supporters stormed out in protest. Under the new HOA rules for Conley Ranches, large-scale gardening on any unsold lots was encouraged. A 5% share of the crops grown on unsold lots was assigned to Cliff Conley, the original landowner and developer of the community. Conley later said that he was more than satisfied with that arrangement. A new HOA security committee was formed. This committee was later jokingly called the Neighborhood Watch on Steroids. After the Doyles arrived, security improvements for the 4 families' compound accelerated. With some hired labor to help, they built stockade-style fences connecting the perimeter of the 4 houses. Ted Nielsen, one of the compound's bankers, had a degree in engineering and had worked for a telephone company on his summer vacations during college. He constructed a simple phone hop loop of 4 traditional rotary dial telephones for the houses. It was powered by 7 car batteries wired in series. This battery bank was connected to a solar panel trickle charger. The dials on the phones were inoperative. They were connected in a traditional party line arrangement. Each phone had a momentary contact switch added. When any of these buttons were depressed, it put a ringing voltage through the circuit and all 4 phones rang. Nielsen's simple phone system provided the means to coordinate a defense of the compound from intruders. The interior fences in the 4-house compound were removed, leaving a large inner courtyard. Most of this area was converted into 4 vegetable gardens. Clearing rocks took several days of hard work. Then soil, compost, and manure were hauled in to be ready for gardening when warm weather returned. At sea, coast of France, December the 1st year. The 1st week at sea was miserable. It was common to see Yvonne and Yvette vomiting over the stern rail in stereo. After the week of seasickness, everyone aboard Duro Brabis got into a regular daily routine. There was plenty of hard work, including countless hours of pulling the handle on the Katahdin Survivor 35 desalinator, A reverse osmosis unit that turns salt water into drinking water. Karsten Sims ran a tight ship and insisted on keeping the freshwater tanks full. Until Andy and the Tafts got accustomed to navigating and handling the rigging, the sailing was mostly handled by Karsten and Angie, who each put in grueling 10-hour watches. Angie piloted from 0500 to 1500, and Karsten from 1500 to 0100. As the days passed, everyone else on the boat took on more and more responsibility in handling the rigging and, eventually, piloting. At the end of his watch, Karsten Sims would either set the Simrad autopilot in calm seas or drop sail and set the sea anchor in rougher seas. Andy's topside security duty was nightly from 2100 to 0800. Every morning after being relieved by Simone Taft, their day watch, eyeballs only security, Andy would carefully oil the SIG and its magazines. He was very conscious of the depredations of damp, salty air on gunmetal. Then he'd do his best to sleep in the darkness of the sail locker. One of Lane's top priorities was familiarizing the adults on the yacht with safe gun handling. He did this in one-on-one classes held late in the afternoons. He taught them how to load, fire, and reload the pistol. Jules got an abbreviated version of the same instruction. The Tafts' 11-year-old twins weren't taught gun handling out of fear that one of them might accidentally drop the precious gun overboard. But they were taught how to refill magazines, which they practiced regularly. Most of the training consisted of dry practice with an unloaded gun, and with all of the gun's ammunition safely in another compartment. But after a week of that, Andy gave Jules and all the adults the chance to actually shoot the SIG. Their targets were sealed empty bottles that were thrown off the bow. In all, they shot just 28 cartridges. After every lesson, Andy said, "If I go down, then you pick this gun up and you continue the fight until the threat is vanquished. You do not quit. Do you understand?" After the first phase of firearms training, Andy moved on to hand-to-hand combatives and knife fighting, using his own amalgam of taekwondo, pistol handling, and Krav Maga, which Lane dubbed Sig-Kwon-Do. Adding to the standard katas, Andy taught how to use a pistol that had been shot dry as a club and as a pressure point tool. For the latter, he used the barrel protruding from the pistol with its slide locked to the rear. The small surface area of the muzzle, he showed, could deliver tremendous force in strikes to the solar plexus, groin, kidneys, or neck of an opponent. Each morning from 10 to noon, Alan Taft taught everyone Spanish. Sailing instruction, also for everyone, took up most of each afternoon. Nearly every night after the dinner dishes were washed, there were endless games of cards, mostly cribbage. Andy was having trouble getting to sleep. They were 250 miles west of Portugal. It was a Tuesday, and his contact was scheduled for that night, so he felt anxious. He was hoping for good propagation. Andy set his radio's alarm for 0315. As he set up the dipole antenna along the rail, he was surprised to see Karsten standing in the open hatchway. In a soft voice, Andy explained what he was doing. Sims nodded. Andy sat down and completed hooking up the transceiver. Then he said, "Well, 5 minutes, and then I'll know if we've got good propagation." Karsten offered, "That can be tricky on short wave." Andy replied, "Yeah." The silence was overwhelming. Andy watched Karsten Sims still standing in the doorway. Still in a whisper, he asked,
"Tell me, how did this boat get the name Duro Brabis?"
Karsten sighed and explained, "She's named after some old Celt ruin somewhere. You see, before I bought her,
This boat belonged to an archaeology professor from the western end of Kent. He only rarely sailed her. After a pause, he added, I didn't particularly like the name, but being an old salt, I consider it bad luck to change a boat's name. At 0329, at Andy's request, Sims tacked to put Durobrabis on a southwesterly heading. This left the dipole antenna roughly facing the Great Circle line of bearing to the western United States. Precisely at 0330 GMT, Andy heard a strong cadence in Morse with Lars's distinctive stuttering fists on his preferred traditional Morse key. K5CLADEK5CLBBT. K5CLADEK5CLBBT. Andy replied, K5CLBDEK5CLABT. Lars hammered back, Hot dang! Got you at S3. Are you at sea? Yes, making good time, FB, now in deep ocean. Had one minor scrape with some BGs when closer to shore off Guinea, BIS, but we sent them packing. No worries. How is KL? She's fine, learning M. Morse and wants to chat. Please put KL on the key. Then, in a ponderously slow Morse rate of 6 words per minute, Andy heard,
I love you, darling. 88, 88, 88, dying to see you. Any ETA? BR.
How could he even begin to explain to her that it might be many months before he got home? Chapter 24. Down in Hondo. We are steadily asked about the age at which to teach young people to shoot. The answer to this obviously depends upon the particular individual, not only his physical maturity, but his desire. Apart from these considerations, however, I think it important to understand that it is the duty of the father to teach the son to shoot. Before the young man leaves home, there are certain things he should know and certain skills he should acquire, apart from any state-sponsored activity. Certainly, the youngster should be taught to swim, strongly and safely, at distance. And young people of either sex should be taught to drive a motor vehicle, and if at all possible, how to fly a light airplane. I believe a youngster should be taught the rudiments of hand-to-hand combat, unarmed, together with basic survival skills. The list is long, but it is a parent's duty to make sure that the child does not go forth into the world helpless in the face of its perils. Shooting, of course, is our business, and shooting should not be left up to the state. Colonel Jeff Cooper. Tegucigalpa, Honduras, May, 2 decades before the crunch. More than 2 decades before the crunch, Ian Doyle had a temporary duty, TDY, assignment to Honduras that changed his life. The leader of the Hondo expedition was Major Alan Brennan, a quiet man who was the son of a retired Air Force colonel. Brennan's leadership was competent, but very laid back. He made it clear that he expected his squadron members to be punctual for all meetings and completely sober before each scheduled mission. He summed up his guidance by stating simply, We've got excellent maintenance NCOs, and the civilian techs know the gear inside and out. Stand back and let them do their jobs. Just be at the briefings and be on flight line on time. Kick the tire, light the fire, and come home safe. Brennan, who had recently been married,
was fascinated by pre-Columbian history and spent a lot of his time off in a rented jeep wandering around ancient ruins taking pictures. Other than on his mission days, Doyle rarely saw him. The Air Force terminated its tactical reconnaissance program for F-16s in 1993, with plans to shift most of those missions to UAVs. But as a follow-on, there was an interim program using the U.S. Navy-developed Tactical Aerial Reconnaissance Pod System, TARPS, mounted on F-16s. Doyle's squadron was one of the two fighter squadrons that got tapped for this strap-on recon test program, which only lasted 18 months. While technically a success, from an operational and logistics standpoint, the results were mixed. And since UAV technology was meanwhile maturing rapidly, the decision was made to mothball the TARPS pods and support gear. It was during the TARPS test program that Ian Doyle was part of the Hondo expedition. By the time that the USAF got involved, the TARPS pods were a well-matured technology. Most of the technical support was supplied by civilian contractors from Grumman, the company that had originally developed the system. The 17-foot, 1,850-pound pods were essentially a strap-on system, adaptable to many types of aircraft. They could be mounted on standard hardpoints, first developed for Navy F-14s and Marine Corps F-A-18s, the TARPS pods were, as one of the Grumman camera technicians put it, foolproof and pilotproof. But then, I repeat myself. The expedition included four F-16s, two for missions and two for spares and side trips, four mission pilots, and a C-130 to shuttle the support crew and umpteen spare parts, both for the planes and for the TARPS pods. The TDY rotation was 5 months, making it just short of the 6-month threshold for a PCS. This made the personnel paperwork easier and reduced the overall cost of the program. All of the pilots were housed at the White House, La Casa Blanca, the guest quarters in Tegucigalpa that were run by the American Embassy in Colonia Loma Linda Norte District on La Avenida FAO. The White House was a gathering place of myth and legend. It served as the catch-all for visiting company-grade military officers, CIA types on temporary assignment, and assorted contractors on government business. The atmosphere was jovial, and there were even some fraternity-style bashes on weekends. The CIA officers called it a safe house, but its presence was hardly clandestine. Even the local newspaper mentioned it from time to time, often by its nicknames, Rick's Café Americain or Rick's Place, in honor of the Humphrey Bogart movie Casablanca. Junior officers at La Casablanca were expected to share rooms. Ian Doyle's roommate was Bryson Pitcher, an Air Force Intelligence First Lieutenant who was permanent party with the intel cell at the American Embassy. Shortly after meeting Pitcher, Ian Doyle summed up the expedition to him. "It's an intense assignment, but a good one. I'll fly 3, maybe 4 missions a week, all in daylight hours, and they are just 6 hours each. Other than some intel briefing dog and pony shows once every 10 or 12 days, either here or down at Sotocano, I get all the rest of my days off to hike, swim, and see the sights. My only regret is that this is only a 5-month TDY. I wish it were a couple of years to really soak up the local culture." Bryson's curiosity was piqued. "Well, what are you doing exactly? This is the first time I've seen F-16s in Hondo. We haven't heard squat about it, even in the intel shop." "I could tell you, but then I'd have to shoot you." Bryson snorted. Ian grinned and said, "Just kidding. What's your clearance?" "TSSBI, with a bunch of funny little letters after that for SCI compartments that I can't tell you about." "Well, what do you do here, Bryson, in a nutshell?" I task and receive reports from a bunch of overeducated NCOs, and we analyze them for liaison with the Honduran government and for an unspecified strategic mission. Stuff from aircraft? Doyle asked. Nope. Stuff from, non-air-breathing platforms.
Ah, gotcha.
Hearing the euphemism for spy satellites made it clear to Doyle that he could ask no further questions.
Okay. Well, then, I guess I can certainly talk about the basics, even though you're in the strategic world while my bailiwick is mostly tactical. A little crossover, I suppose. You'll probably get briefed in a week or two anyway.
Bryson nodded. Ian looked up at the slowly rotating ceiling fan and asked, Are you familiar with a system called TARPS?
Sure. It's the Navy's pod-mounted photo-recon system. It's pretty idiot-proof as long as they remember to hook up the external power and use a squirt of Windex before they take off.
That's the one.
We're going to be using F-16s with TARPS pods flying recon over Columbia, keeping track of the opposition's troop movements. Meanwhile, there are some Army intelligence guys using a system called Guard Rail out of Panama to monitor the FARC's radio transmissions. You piece all that intel together, along with what you guys up in echelons above reality provide, and that gives a pretty complete picture for the theater command, most of which, after it's properly sanitized, can get shared with the host country. Doyle sat up and turned to look at Pitcher, and continued.
It's pretty straightforward stick-and-rudder stuff. I just follow the pre-programmed flight profiles. Fly to these coordinates, spiral down to this altitude, and assume this heading, and fly straight and level for X minutes until you are at these coordinates, then turn to this heading and fly X minutes, then climb out, suck some gas at a tanker, and return to base.
Pitcher chided.
Ha! One of the new UAVs could probably handle that, from a lot closer in than Hondo.
No kidding.
I've been told that it was more political than anything else, to show support for the Colombian and Honduran governments, you know, show the flag. So they didn't want just a man in the loop, but an actual man on the stick. For reasons of physical security on the ground, they couldn't base our planes in-country in Colombia, so they decided to base us at Tegucigalpa.
Wouldn't it be safer for the planes to be at Sotocano?
Yes, but El Presidente likes F-16, so he insisted, since this is just a 5-month gig, that we be here in the capital rather than at Sotocano. I think he's hoping to get a dollar ride in a D model.
You have any 2-seaters down here?
No, but I wouldn't be surprised to see that magically get added to the scope of the mission.
So, basing at Columbia was out, and the political fix was in for Tegucigalpa. Better for you, anyway. At Sotocano, you'd be living in some corrugated steel hoots with no running water, Bryson summarized.
Yeah, it would be muy jodido to have some FARC dude blow up a couple of F-16s on the ramp. As I recall, Vipers were $19 million per copy back when the last ones rolled off the assembly line. Now that production is shut down, the airframes are basically irreplaceable. It would be very bad PR if we lost one.
So, you poor baby. You have 3 or 4 days a week on your hands for the next 5 months to chase skirts and to sip Port Royal beer.
Don't worry. I'll tell you all the best places to go, and I have friends with cars that can take you there.
I'm not much of a skirt chaser. You see, I believe in courting ladies, not dating them. But I have been known to enjoy a good beer.
In moderation, no doubt.
Doyle echoed.
Yes, exactly. In moderation.
Bryson punched his shoulder.
I think you're going to have a blast here.
Doyle's plans for the next 5 months changed radically the next day, when he heard what he later called the voice of an angel, as he came in for a landing approach after a 40-minute operational test flight with the newly fitted carp's pond. The voice on the radio from the control tower sounded enchanting, obviously that of a young woman. Soon after hitting the tarmac, he asked the liaison crew chief about the voice. The master sergeant replied,
"Oh, that's Blanca Araneta. But I've got to warn you, she's single, maybe 21 or 22, and she's an absolute doll. But she's made of pure unobtainium. Many before you have tried and failed, young Jedi."
Doyle immediately took that as a challenge. He got his first glimpse of the young woman as he loitered outside the control tower during the evening shift change. He spotted her just as she stepped into her car, a battered old Mercedes station wagon. Ian was surprised to see that, having heard she was from a wealthy family. She drove away before he had the chance to approach her and introduce himself. She was indeed a beautiful woman, with large, expressive eyes, a perfectly symmetrical face, and full lips. Her shoulder-length black hair was pulled back in a ponytail. Ian Doyle was smitten. He immediately started gathering intelligence and planning a strategy. He first learned that Blanca was indeed from a wealthy family that lived about an hour's drive north of the airbase. After much prying with other members of the control tower staff, Doyle found out that Blanca Araneta was a recent graduate of Universidad Nacional Autónoma de Honduras and was a licensed private pilot. To Ian, this meant bonus points. Finding a woman with whom he could talk aviation and not have her eyes glaze over? She still lived in an apartment near the university. Further inquiries garnered the married name of her college roommate, Consuelo Dalgón, a linguistics major who now taught public school and lived near the airport. Blanca still had a close friendship with Dalgón. After buying a few more beers, he was given Dalgón's phone number. That same evening, Ian phoned her, explaining that he was TDY and was looking for a Spanish tutor. Dalgón immediately answered affirmatively, explaining that she had married another recent graduate who was just getting started as a management trainee, so she could use the extra money. Ian's lessons began the next Saturday at the Dalgón's apartment. Not only did he get a thorough immersion course in Spanish, but he also began to pick up tidbits about the mysterious Señorita Blanca Araneta. He learned that Blanca's father, Arturo Araneta y Vázquez, was a semi-retired mining engineer and investor. He was also a former member of the Honduran Olympic tennis team. Consuelo confided to Ian that Blanca had told her that she hated tennis. This was because she had been forced to take tennis lessons from an early age. Doyle learned that Blanca loved swimming and aerobatic flying. He was also told that Blanca read and wrote English much better than she spoke it. At his next Spanish tutoring session, he found out that Blanca loved almond roca candy. She also liked modern flamenco music, what she called that folky jazz sound. She especially liked the Gypsy Kings, Amic, Paco de Lucia, and Otmar Lieber. Curious, Doyle bought several CDs at the local record store and was instantly hooked. As he listened to this music, he often daydreamed about Blanca, picturing her dancing in a traditional flamenco dress. Ian met Blanca for the first time at the Plaza San Martin Hotel in Tegucigalpa. Consuelo and Blanca often went to the hotel to swim. They had started going while they were in college. Though the pool was ostensibly reserved for hotel guests, the hotel manager quietly let it be known that pretty college girls of good moral character were welcome to come swim at the pool as often as they liked, just to provide some eye candy for the visiting businessmen. To the girls, it was a perfect arrangement. The hotel provided a safe place to park and a safe place to swim. The only downside was that they often got to practice how to politely brush off the occasional lovelorn or just plain lusty business travelers. Only the Japanese ones took pictures. During his third evening lesson with Consuelo, she and her husband Pablo invited Ian to come with them for a swim following the next Saturday lesson. Not wishing to be obvious, Ian didn't ask if Blanca might be meeting them there, but he thought the chances were good. At the Tegucigalpa Multiplaza, Ian picked out a new swimsuit, opting for the long surfer suit look, a dark beach towel, a lightweight windbreaker, and a pair of the best quality leather huarache sandals that they sold. A half hour after their swim session began, Ian emerged from the pool after a set of laps. He was thrilled to see Blanca Araneta had arrived and was sitting on a lounge chair chatting with Consuelo. Toweling himself dry, he walked toward them, doing his best to look nonchalant. Consuelo introduced him to Blanca in Spanish. Señora Dalgón was, after all, a strict believer in true immersion Spanish. Ignoring Consuelo's cue, Blanca switched to English.
A pleasure to be meeting you, Ian.
Hearing the cute way she pronounced his name, more like Ian than Ian, was delightful to Doyle. Avoiding the open chair next to Blanca, he sat down on the lounge that was beyond Consuelo's and Pablo's. He thought it best to talk to Blanca at first from a longer distance, rather than seem overly anxious or intrusive of her space. Speaking to Blanca, over the top of Consuelo's back, Ian said, "Señorita Araneta, I have heard your voice before, from the control tower. I usually fly Viper 124, and you've probably heard my call sign, Subgunner."
"Oh, yes, I know your call sign."
Doyle replied, "Yes, that's me. I always wanted to put a face to your name. I must say, you have a pretty voice, and a very pretty face to go with it." Blanca just smiled and laughed politely. Again, trying to seem nonchalant, Ian added, "Well, enjoy your swim." And he reclined on an unoccupied lounge chair and put on his sunglasses. Lying there, he wondered if he had botched the introduction. His mind was racing. He felt very self-conscious and, oh, so pale-skinned among so many people with olive complexions. He dared not speak. Silently, he recited to himself Proverbs 17:28. "Even a fool is counted wise when he holds his peace. When he shuts his lips, he is considered perceptive." Out of the corner of his eye, he saw Blanca stand up and whip off the ankle-length swimming skirt wrap that she had been wearing. She tossed it on top of her flight bag. He noticed that she carried that bag everywhere. Beneath, she was wearing what by modern standards was a very conservative one-piece swimsuit with an integral skirt, but it couldn't hide her traffic-stopping figure. Ian Doyle gulped and whispered to himself, "Ay, ay, ay." Blanca spent almost 15 minutes in the pool, swimming lap after lap. After she got out and returned to her chair, Ian rose, smiled, and took his own turn in the pool, swimming in a medley of strokes for about 10 minutes. He thought that at this stage, it was best to seem slightly standoffish and more interested in swimming than in chatting her up. After he climbed up the pool's ladder, he could see that Consuelo and Blanca had turned on their chairs and were applying sunscreen to each other's noses. Ian again toweled, but just slightly, returned to his chaise, and put on his sunglasses. Consuelo asked,
"Loqueador de sol, Ian?"
He answered,
"Sí, muchas gracias por su amabilidad, señora,"
and raised his hands as if ready to catch the bottle. But instead of tossing the bottle, Consuelo pivoted to hand him the bottle directly. Leaning forward, she whispered,
"She has been very curious about you."
As Ian slathered the waterproof sunblock on, he explained, "With my skin, I don't tan, I just burn. I'm feeling a little too white to fit in here. I'm just another ugly, ghost-pale gringo." As Ian handed the bottle back to her, Consuelo said matter-of-factly,
"You know, here in our country, many people would be jealous of your fair skin. The more fair, the more aristocratic."
Doyle realized that he had a lot to learn about Honduras. Blanca eyed Doyle for a minute, and, speaking over Consuelo's back, asked,
"Has Consuelo been talking about me to you?"
A little.
Disarmingly, he added, "I also told her about my college roommate."
"So, what did she say?"
Something about your father, tu papa, that he was un experto jugando tenis?"
"Not actually a champion. He was a bronze medaler, medalist, in doubles of tennis."
She cocked her head and asked with a hopeful lilt to her voice,
"Do you like tennis?"
"I've played the game, but, you know, I never really liked it. No me gusta-style tennis. It is just a whole lot of sweating just to hit a ball back and forth, back and forth. And it's kind of an aggravating game. I found it a little too competitive. Even if you practice a lot and hit the ball just right, there's always someone who can hit it just a little bit better or who is just a little bit faster, and they can ace you out. So, no offense, but it's not for me. If I want to practice my hand-eye coordination, I'd rather be in a flight simulator or, better yet, up in the air, formation flying, or doing aerobatics." Blanca smiled.
"Aerobatics?"
"Oh, yeah. The F-16 is built for it. Well, with a big turning radius, that is. Lots of power, great handling. The controls are a dream, incredibly responsive."
"Aye, that sounds wonderful." Consuelo jumped in. "Ian, you should show Blanca those videos you shot from the back seat that you showed me and Pablo."
"Si, senora. Me encantaria." At a loss for the right words in Spanish, he finished, "to do so." After a moment, he added, "That video may make you dizzy to watch, and there's not much narration, just me and the pilot grunting, you know, tightening our abdominal muscles, doing our best to pull the G's."
"No, it won't make me dizzy," Blanca said.
She then just smiled, nodded dismissively, and lay back down, putting on sunglasses and pulling her sun hat over her head. But Doyle noticed that she was looking in his direction. With her large, dark sunglasses, he couldn't be sure if she was sleeping or staring at him. He was having trouble reading her. Was she genuinely interested, or just being polite and properly social? He decided that it was best to just give her more of the silence and sunbathing treatment. He reached down and pulled out his Sony Discman portable CD player and put the headphones on. He closed his eyes and got lost in the music for a few minutes. Then he noticed something had shaded his face. He opened his eyes to see Blanca standing over him.
"Oh, hola, Señorita Araneta," he said casually.
Gesturing to his CD player, she asked,
"What are you playing on that thing?"
"Oh, this? Here, take a listen." Blanca perched on the edge of Consuelo's lounge chair, and Ian handed her the Discman. She leaned forward to put the headphones on her head. It was the first time that he had ever touched Blanca. It gave him a tingle. Blanca put on a huge grin the instant she heard the music.
"You like Otmar Liebert? No way! This is his first album, Nuevo Flamenco. You really like it?"
"Yeah, I sure do. I'm a recent convert to that music. I've really gotten hooked on flamenco guitar since I came down here." She nodded.
"Well, Ian, what is currently your favorite band?"
"I'd have to say the Gypsy Kings. It's almost hypnotic. From the first time I heard them sing Bamboleo, I just couldn't get it out of my head." Blanca shook her head in disbelief, then smiled, and said softly,
Ah, I really like them, too.
The next time that Ian met Blanca was at a weeknight dinner party just 3 days later, hosted by Consuelo and Pablo. The evening before, in halting Spanish, Doyle asked Consuelo,
"How should I dress for this?"
For the first time at one of his immersion class sessions, Consuelo lapsed into English.
"Well, it is a dinner. You should wear a coat and a tie."
"I'm just TDY down here, and I don't have a suit with me. The only thing I have with a tie is my service dress uniform."
"That will be fine. Wear that."
Ian arrived early, carrying a clear plastic grocery bag with a bottle of Chilean white wine and a can of almond roca. In the crook of his other arm were two large bouquets of white orchids. Inviting him in, Pablo Dalgón said,
"You can relax, Ian. We're speaking all English tonight. This is not a class night. Purely social."
Ian was taken aback to see that Blanca was already there. Doyle handed the flowers to Consuelo and said,
"I brought a bunch for each of you."
Pablo exclaimed jokingly,
"Oh, how nice of you! Flowers for both of us."
Consuelo gave Pablo a sharp look and elbowed him in the ribs, chiding,
"He means flowers for both of the ladies."
Pablo laughed and said,
"I know, just kidding."
As Blanca and Consuelo each took their bouquets, Blanca glanced down to see what was in the bag. She recognized the pink can. Her jaw dropped a bit, and she gave Doyle a quizzical look. In rapid damage control mode, Doyle explained,
"I heard from Consuelo that you liked almond roca, so I bought a can. You know, to serve with dessert."
As Consuelo began serving dinner, Blanca's eyes locked onto the can of candy sitting on the sideboard. Then she stared at Ian. Blanca started laughing. She pointed with a scolding finger at Doyle and said,
"Ian, I think you are trying to manipulate me."
"Yes, I am, Senorita. I freely admit that. But I'm doing so in a kind of nice, gentlemanly way."
Through the rest of the dinner, the talk was mainly about aviation and differences between American and Honduran customs. It was a very pleasant evening. Pablo was quiet, as was his nature. Ian and Blanca made plenty of eye contact. Consuelo, clearly looking like a victorious matchmaker, steered the conversation. She often returned to topics in which she gave Ian and Blanca opportunities to ask each other questions and talk about their accomplishments. After dinner, Consuelo served flan with a piece of almond roca, topping each piece of the gelatinous dessert. She was quite the diplomatic hostess. Pablo and Consuelo stepped out to clear the dishes. In phrasing that he had practiced several times with Consuelo's coaching, Ian asked Blanca in Spanish,
"Señorita Araneta, I wish to ask your permission to court you in the coming days with completely honorable intentions, if you would be so kind as to have me in your presence."
Her answer was immediate.
"You may call me Blanca. And, yes, you may court me, with your promise to be a gentleman."
Their next meeting was a lunch the following day at the airbase canteen. But just as their conversation was starting, it was cut short. One of Blanca's co-workers rushed to their table and exclaimed that the tower boss had fallen ill with a flu, and Blanca was needed back at the control tower. Then he turned and stepped away just as quickly as he had arrived. Blanca stood and said,
"I'm now in a hurry here, so this, as you say, is the Reader's Digest version. I like you a lot, Ian. I think you are fascinating. So now it is the time I should take you up to the estancia so mi papa can give you the, third degree. You are seeming just way, way too good to be true. And my father, He is an expert at digging out the flaws of character in suitors. We'll see if he can scare you off.
She raised her index finger and added,
He has scared off all the others, you know. I'll schedule a dinner for next Saturday.
Before he could answer, Blanca smiled, gave a little wave, and dashed away. Ian sat dumbfounded at what he had just heard. Then he said a long, silent prayer and ate his lunch. To meet Blanca's father, Ian decided to wear a suit instead of his service dress uniform. But borrowing a suit that would fit him well took some scrambling, as did finding cufflinks and dress shoes. This turned into an evening-long scavenger hunt for many of the junior officers and GS-9s who lived on his floor of Rick's place. Knocking on doors up and down the hall, Bryson Pitcher led Doyle and a parade of suit beggars. This turned into a movable party with plenty of alcohol served. Doyle heard repeatedly, "This deserves a toast." The lovely Blanca Araneta was a legendarily unreachable enigma for anyone who worked in flight operations, so the reactions were a mix of envy and awe. The envy came mostly from the officers who were there on PCS assignments. They were miffed that a newly arrived TDY-02 could break the ice with Blanca, and so quickly. Blanca drove over from her apartment and picked Ian up at just after 3 p.m. for the hour-long drive to her family's 90-hectare estancia, which was about 3 miles outside of Talanga. Blanca wore a simple black dress with a very modest neckline and hemmed below the knee. She wore very little makeup. Her hair was combed out and worn loosely. This was the first time that Ian had seen it in anything but a simple ponytail. The only adornment she wore was a single, large, teardrop-shaped pearl on a gold chain. Ian thought she looked gorgeous. She definitely had the Grace Kelly vibe going, understated but stunning. The drive north from Tegucigalpa was fairly quiet and revealed the nervousness they both felt. There were just a few comments on the scenery and a bit of travelogue from Blanca on the local history and age of certain buildings. Ian felt a new level of anxiety as she turned the car into the estancia's long driveway. Even from a distance, Doyle could see that the house was huge and that it had stables off to one side. Just before they stepped out of the Mercedes, Ian straightened his borrowed silk tie. Blanca whispered,
Bring your video camera. My papa will want to see pictures.
After the maid ushered them in, they met Blanca's father on the screened patio. As was customary, Blanca began the introductions.
Papa, este es mi amigo, Ian.
Ian carried on haltingly.
Mucho gusto, señor Araneta. Su hija habla de usted con mucha admiración. Es un honor y un placer conocerlo.
I am pleased to meet you, sir. Your daughter speaks with great admiration about you. It is an honor and a pleasure to meet you. Ian did this fairly well, since he had practiced it with Consuelo, but he was obviously nervous. After shaking hands, Arturo Araneta asked,
So, Lieutenant Doyle, my daughter tells me you are a pilot of F-16 fighting planes.
That's right, sir. Pointing to the rucksack on his shoulder, he said, I brought my camcorder with some movies of myself and some of my squadron mates flying F-16s, if you are interested.
Of course, of course. Let's go to the library.
Arturo Araneta asked as they walked,
You have this movie in your video camera?
Yes, sir.
Then let's watch it on my big screen. It is the latest from Japan.
The dimly lit library was quite a contrast to the brightness of the patio. It took a while for Doyle's eyes to adjust to the lighting. As they were getting the camera's cable hooked up to the television input jack, Arturo Araneta asked Ian,
So,
Where did you go to college?
Without looking up, Ian said, The University of Chicago. Arturo pointed to the jacks on the front of the television and said, You may attach the cables here.
And what did you study?